What's up, everybody? This is Chef Marcus Samuelson, the other half of This Moment, the transatlantic bridge between Sweden and New York City and connecting BIPOC communities across the world. The other half is my co-host, hip-hop legend icon Jason Diakite, a.k.a. Timbuktu. And on this week, we're going to do a rerun of one of our favorite episodes on This Moment, episode 37, A Moment of Truth, featuring no other than the godfather of the green space, former Vice President Mr. Al Gore. He speaks to us about going to Vietnam, being a journalist, going into public space, becoming a vice president, and then for one of his biggest acts, producing the movie An Inconvenient Truth. And also a little bit of COVID talk. It's a good listen. Check it out.
If we would have done this interview just a year ago, part of the team is in Maine, Jason is in Sweden, you're in Tennessee. We all would have waited for the day when we all would be in New York or something like that. And, you know, there is a silver line and there is something that we'll learn. And specifically for someone like yourself that have worked so much on the environment and really changed in terms of business travel. So there is something that 2020 has taught us in that. When we go back to the new normal, do you think people are going to cut down? What do you see happening with travel?
Well, a lot of people trying to figure out the answer to that question. I don't know that I'm certain about it, but I think it's more likely than not that we will emerge from the pandemic into what some are calling a hybrid world with much more online activity than before the pandemic. But, you know, given the fact that old patterns tend to reassert themselves and persist over time, it's hard to predict, really, because the lack of physical proximity to people you love and people you work with, that's going to reassert itself in the form of I want to get together. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But boy, I'll tell you, I gave a speech in Singapore a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't miss the round trip air travel one bit.
Well, Mr. Vice President, we wanted to go back a bit to the beginning of the beginnings of you. Do you recall a eureka moment in your youth where you decided that you wanted to dedicate your life to public service, to politics? Was there such a moment?
My father was an elected official. He was in the House of Representatives and the Senate. He'd been in the House for 10 years before I was born and was elected to the Senate when I was 4 years old and left when I was in the Army on the way to Vietnam. And when I was a little boy, like a lot of children, I wanted to do what my father did in this case. My mother was a hero to me. She was one of the first women to graduate from Vanderbilt Law School here, but she really sublimated her career into my dad's. But after watching the successive presidencies of Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon and seeing the tragedy of the Vietnam War unfold based on lies like the invasion of Iraq in 2003 later on, I decided that actually politics would be the last thing I did. And I kind of moved away from it. After I graduated from college, I became a journalist for 7 years and graduated to investigative reporting, which was not a thing well known back then, but I really loved it. Got involved in some trials of people that my stories had gotten indicted and decided to go to law school to figure out what this law thing is all about. Both my parents were lawyers. And when I was in law school, still working at the newspaper at nights, a congressional seat came open, and I had then become attracted back to the idea of public service on my own terms, not just wanting to follow my dad. And I jumped into that race, and I'm telling you, it was just thrilling to have a chance to take part in American democracy at its best. I could hear the battle hymn of the Republic being hummed in the background when I had these town hall meetings, five every week. I loved it, loved it, loved it. But I was drawn toward it, then pulled away, and then went back into it. My name is Al Gore, and you're listening to This Moment. My proper title, so you'll know, is Your Adequacy.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
One of the things that I admire and we can really all learn from you is how to move on and how to pivot. This is the year of pivoting. And I think about the transitions that you've done all the way from the 60s and then thinking about the Vietnam Wars in the 70s and being a reporter to going into politics. But I think actually even more impressive, getting the world excited and learning about environmental. How was those moments? Each one is very big and it's very public. Could you please give us some insight on that?
Yeah, thanks for asking. You know, I began my work on climate, my obsession with climate, really back in the 1960s. When I was an undergraduate in college, I didn't major in science, but I had the freedom to take some courses outside of what I was studying mainly. And I walked into the classroom of a man named Roger Revelle, who I didn't know it at the time, was one of the greatest climate scientists in history. He was the first one to design the experiments to measure CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere. And everything that's happened since then, he saw it coming. And he's the one that really opened my eyes. And when I jumped into that congressional race 7 years after I graduated from college, I had kept in touch with him. And when I got to Congress, I asked my colleagues there, what are we doing about global warming, which is what we call the climate crisis then? And the answer was nothing. And I got permission to organize the first congressional hearing on climate. And I invited my professor to be the lead-off witness, and I naively thought that my colleagues on the dais up there in Congress would have the same epiphany that I had had, not realizing dumbly that a 20-minute congressional statement's not really the equivalent of a full college course. And when they kind of yawned and didn't really open up to this startling revelation the way it had happened with me spending so much time with Professor Revelle, that's the first time I started asking myself the question, how can I communicate this great man's message in language that I can understand and therefore use to communicate it to others? And I continued in my congressional days, and when I got to the vice presidency, I really focused on it then. And after the Supreme Court decision that ended the presidential election 20 years ago in 2000, I thought long and hard about running for president again. But then 9/11 happened, and it seemed to me that maybe I could do good in other ways. And that's when I decided to take my flip charts, and I had a slideshow with Kodak projector, and then I got really fancy, and I got three Kodak projectors that, and they would alternate the three of them. I thought that was the cat's meow. And then when my friend Steve Jobs, who I'd known since the late 70s, invited me to join the Apple board, he said, you know, that's a good slideshow, Al, but we've got these things called computers, and you really ought to put them on a computer. And that's when it became possible to modify it every day and to learn and grow with it. And finally, I got it to the point where I was here in Tennessee out on then I didn't have a houseboat. I rented a houseboat. And I had my buddies drinking beer on the front of the houseboat, and I showed them the slideshow. When they reacted to it, that's the first time I realized I've got something that can connect. And that's when I, you know, I haven't looked back since then.
This moment.
I remember in 2006 seeing An Inconvenient Truth. Everybody saw it. And it's really, you turned climate activism or environmental awareness into pop culture in that moment. I think a lot of it has to do with the graphs, the slides, the illustration of what was going on. And that really drove it home. It reminds me of a Swedish scientist who is also unfortunately passed away, Hans Rosling, who also used these who you probably met, Mr. Vice President.
Many, many times. And
so how did you end up there? But, you know, sorry.
First of all, I want to honor the memory of Hans Rosling and his family is continuing some of his great work. You know, I'm so dumb about some of these things. I'll tell you the true story of this. I was connecting with that slideshow, and there was a movie that came out called, I think it was called The Day After. It was, you know, about an instant ice age. And I remember doing interviews and they said, isn't this fictional? And I said, yes, it is fictional, but it's not as fictional as the Bush and Cheney people are telling you their story about climate. Anyway, during my efforts to help promote that, there was a woman named Lori David who saw that slideshow and she said, we've got to make this into a movie. And honestly, I said, you're crazy. You can't make a slideshow into a movie. And I that was my sincere opinion. And I already confessed to being dumb about these things. As a high school student, I had tried to cram for a course on Shakespeare by looking at movies that were made of stage plays, and they were so boring. I shouldn't admit that, but to me it was. And I thought, well, you can't take one medium and put it on film. And what I didn't realize that in Hollywood, they've got some pretty smart, creative people. And Davis Guggenheim, the director of An Inconvenient Truth, did a brilliant job making it into a movie. And thank you for your kind words about it. It did make it possible for me to take this message to a lot more people. And we did a follow-up movie a decade later with John Schenck and Bonnie Cohen directing it. And, you know, I show it all over the world virtually now, and I do these trainings for the Climate Reality Project. And just in the last few months, I've trained 10,000 new climate reality leaders in every country around the world. I can train a lot more people over the course of a week online than having them all get on planes and go to wherever we're having the physical training. Now, for all your kind words, I have to say, I sometimes joke and I say, well, thank you. You know, if it hadn't been for me, we'd have a big problem right now. I mean, I feel like I've been able to play a constructive and useful role. But we really are facing this existential crisis. We're gaining momentum, but this thing is for real, as you guys know. And luckily, I do think the world is kind of crossing the political tipping point right now. I'm optimistic about it.
No, absolutely.
I wanted to ask you about that optimism. You know, a person who's become world famous, but who's also here from Sweden, as you know, is Greta Thunberg, who was only 3 years old when An Inconvenient Truth came out. And celebrating, but marking the fifth year anniversary of the Paris Accord, you wrote an amazing op-ed in the New York Times, which was really broad and informative and just poignant in this in this moment. And she also released a video on The Guardian through the British newspaper, The Guardian. And you both, there are many connecting points, but hope is one of the main connecting points. And to me, you know, as a citizen of the world, I find it hard, especially in 2020, to maintain a hopeful perspective on the future. It's easy to fall into dystopic prospects just for our species and our lives. How do you maintain that hope, Mr. Vice President? And how do you feed that hope?
Well, the alternative is not very attractive. You know, the old cliche, denial ain't just a river in Egypt. You could add to that. You could add to that. Despair ain't just a tire in the trunk. It's part of the problem that we have to overcome. And actually, if you look back at the history of these great morally based movements in world history, back to abolition of slavery and women's suffrage and the civil rights movement in the U.S. and the anti-apartheid movement, more recently the LGBTQ movement. In all of those movements, there was plenty of cause for despair, and there were plenty of times when the advocates felt like, oh, gosh, we're never going to be able to do this. But then when the underbrush was cleared away and the central choice was revealed as a choice between what's right and what's wrong, then the outcome became inevitable. And in each of those prior movements, the turning point came not long after young people made it their cause. And the arrival of Greta Thunberg and her generation, marching every week now virtually during the pandemic often, that has been a turning point here. And if you look at the advances in technology, like solar and wind and batteries and electric vehicles and efficiency improvements of all kinds and more on the way, well, let me draw an analogy real quick. The pandemic's been so awful, but we have seen these dramatic advances in biotechnology give the scientists the ability to create vaccines in record time. And they apparently they work better than vaccines ever have, and they seem to be safe. And so in the same way, this still accelerating scientific revolution is giving us advances in fields like renewable energy that are going to make it much easier to solve this crisis. If you look last year at all the new electricity generation built and installed worldwide, 90% of it was solar and wind. And it's on the way up to 95%. So I could give you other examples, but I think the hope is justified. Unfortunately, some damage has been done, and regrettably, some of it is not recoverable. We're going to lose some low-lying areas, islands and river deltas in Bangladesh and Galveston, Texas, in plenty of places. But we still have the ability to stop the truly catastrophic damage that poses a threat to the future of human civilization.
This moment.
I want to go back a little bit. You know, when you and Bill Clinton takes over the White House, there is a wave of youth. And I go back and look at these amazing images that we've all seen. And you guys are so young. And it's a hope that's sent out to the world. And when you started the environmental journey, it works because some of those actions are being taken place in any company today. If you start a company today, you need technology and you need to think about environmental. And the fact that this is a relay, so someone like Greta is carrying that, it means that it's worked.
There are a lot of young people in the United States and really in countries all over the world who are taking this cause up. The Sunrise Movement in the U.S., Zero Hour, I could name a number of others. And many of them are the same age as Greta. She inspired so many. I've had the privilege of meeting her on a number of occasions, and I really cheer her on. She is so great. And these other young people who are doing similar things are really having an impact. And it's not only in activism and NGOs, it's also happening in big parts of the business community. I also wear a hat in the investment world and investing in solutions to this. And I find now that companies who hire the brightest and best young women and men coming out of colleges and universities and technical schools, when they interview them, these young people are interviewing the company at the same time, and they don't want to work for a company that doesn't share their values. Right. They want to make a good income, of course, but they want to be able to tell their friends and peers and families that they're helping to make the world a better place. Investors are also playing a huge role. I want to give a shout out to a foundation in Sweden that a lot of people don't know about called Mistra. They've been pioneers for a long time. And the Church of Sweden, for example, I've spent a lot of time there, and Sweden's been one of the leaders on this whole thing. But the young people are taking the baton right now, and they're a major source of optimism for me.
Would you say that it's fair to describe this current pandemic as a consequence of an ongoing environmental crisis? I'm thinking about the shrinking animal habitats, wildlife habitats, and as far as people coming in contact with wildlife and that giving birth to new viruses and diseases. Can we say that that COVID-19 actually is a consequence of the environmental crises?
Well, it certainly made the pandemic a lot more likely. We are now seeing the emergence of five new zoonotic diseases. I had to look up the word zoonotic in the dictionary when I first encountered it. It apparently means diseases that move from animals to humans. We're getting five new ones every year. And that is a consequence in large measure of our continuing encroachment into the previously wild areas of the world. It's also a consequence of the climate crisis in the sense that the average land animal species is moving toward the poles at an average rate of 5 meters per day. And one of the consequences is species that didn't used to encounter one another are now bumping into species they haven't dealt with in the past. And that increases the transmission of these zoonotic diseases. So yes, but the pandemic and the climate crisis are linked in other ways. When the scientists who are expert on pandemics, the virologists and the epidemiologists started warning us years ago about a pandemic almost exactly like the one we're still trying to escape from, they were largely ignored. And I think that has given new meaning to the significance of scientific warnings. And when the climate scientists for even longer have been setting their hair on fire trying to get our attention about the climate crisis, and all I do in my slideshow, you realize, is just I just channel what the scientists are saying, and they're kind enough to spend enough time with me to drill it into my head in simple language. They've been warning us for a long time, and having seen the consequences of ignoring the experts on pandemics, I think that has opened people's minds to a new awareness of how it's pretty important to listen to these scientists when they know what they're talking about and they're warning us that we've got to protect ourselves.
I mean, it's interesting that the pandemic connects the environmental crises also with something that Marcus and I talk about a lot in this podcast, with which is something that the pandemic has uncovered in a big way, and that is social injustice and social inequity as to who is affected by not only the climate crisis, but also the pandemic.
Absolutely. And it's another thing that the pandemic and the climate crisis have in common. Those who are most harmed by it are far more likely to be Black or indigenous or Hispanic, and certainly low income. We're seeing that in both cases. And in developing countries, people in the nations that have contributed least to the climate crisis are in danger of suffering the most harm from the climate crisis. It will affect everyone, but the first victims are in these low-income, marginalized communities around the world. One other link, if I may. There are now multiple studies around the world that show that the air pollution that comes from burning fossil fuels, I mean, it releases CO2, which goes up into the atmosphere of the Earth and traps all the heat. But at the same time, it produces the conventional particulate air pollution. And Black, brown, and indigenous communities are way more likely to live downwind from the smokestacks and downstream from the liquid chemical waste. If you're breathing in more air pollution, you are way more vulnerable to COVID-19. So it's been a real wake-up call, and coupled with the George Floyd murder and the other tragic incidents that really took the blinders off people's eyes. Why it took so long, you'll have to ask somebody more expert than me. But all of a sudden, people went, wow, we can't tolerate this. And now the environmental justice community is taking that same great awakening and applying it to belatedly remedy the environmental racism that has been going on for way too long.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
People are being nudged and land on these big questions at their own time, right? I remember when I watched Inconvenient Truth and to change my behavior. I've been thinking about it so much. Like, what is that going to look like? I felt that moving to Harlem, working, the greenest thing I could do was to hire people in my community and support Black farmers. And so that's really what Red Rooster became and our food festivals and so on. But then also when
Greta started her movement, I started to think about my son that is five. I can't just do this and continue to work. And when he is part of the restaurant, when he's part of the goes to college, there needs to be a couple of questions he's going to ask about. There's basically, I think, three things. Inclusion, you know, we talk about it all the time at home. Environmental, right? And he needs to be tech savvy. Those three things. So for me, 2020, 21, after the pandemic, during the pandemic, I started thinking about the next restaurant that's going to be about environmental and sustainability and supporting BIPOC, right? So these, I'm just saying this journey happened to me, and Jason takes it in his way, and someone at a large tech company is taking it in that way. And that's really how behaviors on a local level start to happen. And I think that farming is the next big thing that we're connected to as chefs, right? How does modern farming look like in the next 10 years? And also, I know at the conference that you had a couple of months ago, there were Black farmers there that will also wants to participate. I know it's economically very, very expensive, but walk us through a little bit about modern farming and how does that eventually land on Black and BIPOC farmers?
Yeah, great question. And you contributed so much to that conference, Marcus. Thank you again. And by the way, one of the developments in recent years has been all of a sudden a lot of chefs have become superheroes. And by the way, Jason, some rappers have too.
Absolutely.
People are realizing, you know, the scope and magnitude of the challenges we face, and those who realize that they have a platform, more than a few are saying, hey, I'm going to use my platform to be part of the solution. So to stay with the chefs here, there have been some amazing new innovations, and congratulations on Red Rooster. And I'm very excited about your new venture after the pandemic, Marcus. But just to turn to your question, you know, farming since the building of the mechanized diesel-powered tractors more than 100 years ago, they took that, hooked up the metal plows, and broke the prairies in the U.S. and plowed up land all over the world because that seemed like the easiest way to get rid of weeds and prepare the ground and plant the seeds and so forth. And then they dump all this poison on there to kill everything except the plants, and not realizing that the magic in agriculture is really coming from all of the very varied life forms in the soil. And the soil has a kind of a skin on it. And when you break that skin and tear it up and then dump these chemicals, then you're killing the life forms in the soil. You can still grow and plants for sure, but you have to use the equivalent of steroids with the synthetic nitrogen fertilizer and all these poisonous chemicals. Well, the result was the Dust Bowl in the U.S. and in some other places, and the development of a dependence on these chemicals. And, of course, these life forms will come back, and the pests develop immunities, and then you have to use more chemicals. And the good news is that this movement known as regenerative agriculture actually benefits farmers, produces healthier food for the people that eat it. And you said it's expensive. Actually, people are making a go of it because they're saving money on diesel fuel, saving money on the insecticides and herbicides, and on the vast amounts of nitrogen fertilizer. And there's a little transition period, but people are finding that it's better. I want to say a couple other things. Last year, 2019, one of the big climate-related disasters in the U.S. was flooding. We now have these rain bombs, you know, these historic downpours all over the world. because most of the heat that's trapped is going into the oceans, and that's causing the oceans to put a lot more water vapor into the sky, and it's carried by these atmospheric rivers over the land. And warmer air holds a lot more moisture, so we get these rain bombs. Well, anyway, there were 20 million acres in the upper Midwest of the U.S. that could not be planted last year. But within that amount, there were several hundred thousand acres that actually survived it, were planted, and yielded a good crop. What they had in common, those were the farms that had switched over to regenerative agriculture. Because when you don't do the plowing and break the skin and tear up the soil, if you keep roots in the ground, including diverse cover crops, which also puts more nutrients into the soil and makes the plants healthier, the farmers become more resilient. Now, there is an opportunity to give money to the farmers that adopt regenerative agriculture when we can accurately measure the buildup of soil carbon, because right now there's a big carbon credit market around the world, and a lot of it goes to people that own big stands of trees, and they put them in trust, and they're never going to cut them, and they get checks in the mail. Well, you can see trees with satellites, but you can't see below the ground to the soil carbon, but there are ways to measure it, verify those measurements. And not long from now, you're going to see the emergence of carbon credits paid for to farmers that build up their soil carbon. And that extra amount of money is going to encourage even more farmers to adopt regenerative agriculture. And it's so great when chefs partner with farmers. And we've got to rebuild the supply chains. That's another whole subject. But I'm optimistic about this, and you saw and heard some great fellow chefs, Marcus, at the conference in Tennessee, we do this every year, and there's a lot of activity going on in this area now.
Wonderful.
Speaking of chefs, Mr. Vice President, one thing I didn't know about you but found out during the research preparing for this interview was that you went vegan a couple of years back. Tell us a little bit about that. How does that feel for you?
Well, I made the switch 7 years ago, Jason, I did it really more or less as an experiment to see what it was like. And I began to feel better and felt healthier. I began to lose weight easily, more easily than in the past. And so I just decided to stick with it. Now, every once in a while, I will add some seafood into the mix, but it's predominantly vegan every meal. And I just do it because I feel better. And, you know, the cardiologists will tell you to cut back on the meat anyway. And on a planetary basis, if the whole world adopted the Western meat-intensive diet, we'd be cooked. Where our future is concerned. Mm-hmm. So I'm heartened that people are beginning to eat less meat, beginning to focus more on a plant-based diet. Yeah,
I'm impressed, because also one of the things I think about when I think of Tennessee, where you are, is barbecue. And I would just imagine how much you must miss it. You know, I don't know, Marcus, can you barbecue a vegetable as good as you can meat?
Absolutely.
Know.
And, you know, it's you all about...
If you're a talented chef.
It's all about the fire and heat. I want to ask just one quick last question. And I think this is important because we live in such a polarized world where people almost shut off. And I think if we can, in 21, if we're going to heal and we're going to move forward, we need to be listened to another person's point of view. Especially in this day and age where there's so many rabbit holes where you can just stay on your point of view through internet and through all of that. And also when you brought up environmental questions to Congress and they were not listening, this was a different point of view. What exercise, is there an advice that you can give our listeners to, like, how do I bring up the odd view or the not the hippest idea at the moment? And how do I stand for it? Because you clearly have done this on a world stage, many, many times, and doing it convincing Mr. Bill Clinton a different point of view, that's as hard as it gets.
Well, we were the closest of friends, and during those years, almost like brothers, and a little bit like the Marcus and Jason show. Yeah. You know, two heads are better than one. But it was an honor to serve in that position. And broadening out the focus of my answer, there is now a widespread recognition that more diversity in any decision-making group will benefit the decisions made. Collective thinking is tricky, but the experts will tell you that you want maximum diversity, except for one thing. You want to share the same values. If your group shares the same values, then any difference in perspective that you can reach out to, of course, you need gender diversity because that's half the world, a little more than half the world, but diversity on race and ethnicity and religion and sexual orientation and physical ability, disability, or I don't know the right word there. It all contributes to a smarter collective process of thinking. One time I went to see the satellites on top of one of the big volcanoes on the big island of Hawaii, and the most powerful telescope in the world for seeing supernovas has an innovative design. Bear with me here. You think I'm taking you down a rabbit hole, but one of the innovative designs was they have two identical telescopes about 85 meters apart. And here's what really blew my mind with the explanation. If you're looking at a target in the universe 100 million light years away, a separation of only 85 meters on the surface of the Earth vastly enhances the amount of meaning that you can pull from that target of your observation. A different point of view. So long as you're after the same things and share the same values, there is immeasurable benefit to be gained by tapping into the wisdom of people who are looking at it from a different life experience, a different culture, a different religious and faith background. So yes, but you've got to get that coherence with the same values.
We just want to thank you so much for being part of this moment family. And I can't wait to come down to Tennessee next year and be part of your conference, wherever we can contribute. Very, very happy to be part of it. And it's been such an honor, Mr. Vice President. Thank you for everything that you've given to us in the world.
Thank you so much. Thanks to both of you. It's a great honor to appear on your podcast. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vice President.
We'd also like to give a special thanks to Lisa Berg, Nick Conger, Jane Samuels, and Brad Squires. Peace.
Thanks again, Mr. Vice President. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. I hope all of you guys learned something and enjoy the listen. Have a great summer, everybody. Peace.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.